When we left off last week, we were in chapter 6, around verse 12. But before I start there this week, I want to go back and say a few introductory comments, some of the things that we talked about in the introduction, and a few things that we did not. I think now that we have our feet wet, so to speak, looking at some of the judgments and some of the prophecies, it's probably a good idea now to circle back and kind of get our bearings and see where we are and address a few questions that have come up or that generally come up at this point in the lessons. First question is, does Revelation have any relevance for us today? As you know, I've made the point several times that this book has a time frame, and that to really understand the book, we need to understand the time frame, and the time frame is that the things in the book were to shortly come to pass. Now, that raises the question, and with some people, and perhaps many, as to whether this book really has any relevance for us today. We considered that a little bit in our introductory lessons, but let's look at that question again. At one level, we know the answer is yes, that it does have relevance without regard to how we interpret it, because Revelation is God's Word, and that alone makes it relevant. When the Creator of the universe hands you a book and asks you to read it, then that book is relevant. And that is certainly true of the book of Revelation. It is our spiritual food, and I know not many of us question the relevance of eating and of food. At another level, we have frequently compared the judgments in Revelation to the judgments in the Old Testament, those against Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Edom, etc., etc. And we know the relevance of those Old Testament judgments, how valuable they are, the kind of lessons we learn from them, the expressions of God's love and of His wrath and His judgment that we get from those Old Testament judgments. So that's another way in which this New Testament judgment of Rome is relevant. But I think we also must agree there's a difference between the Old Testament judgments and the New Testament judgment, and that's because this New Testament judgment involves the church. And that makes it, in a third way, relevant to us today. If you ever wondered how Jesus feels about His church, read Revelation. If you've ever wondered how much Jesus loves His church, read Revelation. Have you ever looked at all the evil in the world around you and asked, how long, O Lord? Read Revelation. Revelation is relevant on any level. Question 2. Don't all of those seals that we studied fit the fall of Jerusalem pretty well? And you could also insert some other things there, but generally it's the fall of Jerusalem that people ask about. And the answer is yes, they do fit them pretty well. In fact, if you look at Matthew 24, you'll find some very similar, sometimes exactly the same, language describing the fall of Jerusalem. But if you look in the Old Testament, you'll find again very similar language describing Babylon, Assyria, Egypt, and others. So again, similarity of language does not prove identity of subject. In my opinion, the villain in this book is Rome. And the judgments in this book are against Rome, the villain in the book. Others have different opinions. Many take Jerusalem to be the villain in the book, with the judgments being against Jerusalem. Others take Rome to be the villain with the judgments against Rome and Jerusalem. In my opinion, the best fit is for Rome to be the villain and the judgments to be against the same villain, that is, against Rome. If we had more time, I would go through all the different, or many of the different views on it, and kind of explain to you why they're good points and also what I think are some of their bad points and why I don't believe they're the best fit. All I can do here is lay out my case from the Bible and then let you all decide. But there are many other theories, as you know, about this book. Do I think my view is the only possible view and no other theory has any merit? Well, of course not. I don't believe that at all. In fact, if you look at my website, you'll find there a commentary on Revelation that I compiled and wrote back in 1993 when I was first teaching this book. And if you look at that and what I'm saying now, you'll see I've changed my mind on a few of the issues. And so there are some that have a lot of merit. But there are also some views of this book that have no merit, that are totally without merit. Premillennialism, for example, comes to mind. But there are other views different than mine that do not ignore the time frame, or at least don't totally ignore the time frame, and that fit portions of the book quite well. But again, the view I'm putting forth is what I believe best fits the evidence. One final comment on this point. In our introductory classes, we talked a little bit about dual fulfillment. And we know that some of the Old Testament prophecies had dual fulfillments. They had an immediate fulfillment, and then they had a later fulfillment that came about with regard to Christ and the church. Is that a possibility for some of the judgments and the prophecies in Revelation? It is. Can we know for certain whether any of these have a dual fulfillment? The answer is no, we can't. How do we know some of the Old Testament prophecies had dual fulfillments? We know that because the New Testament tells us. It comes right out and says, here is a second fulfillment of that prophecy. So we know for certain it had a dual fulfillment. If we were to do the same with Revelation, though, it would just be speculation because we do not have some other book later telling us about a dual fulfillment. So I'm talking about the immediate fulfillment of these prophecies, and I think that is with regard to Rome. Anything else, I think, would just be speculation. Third question. How do the images we have seen fit with the fall of Rome? That's a question we're going to have a lot more to say about as we proceed through the book. But let's say a few points here. The images we have seen are intended to frighten. That's why they're here. And I think we can all agree they succeeded in that. Even today, the pale horse of pestilence is a frightening image. And we've seen the frightening part of that even in our world around us today with regard to the influenza and all of that sort of thing that's making the news. Are we then to look for an actual pestilence that hit Rome at some point? Are we to look through Rome's history to find some actual pestilence that hit Rome? I think the answer is not necessarily. Instead, we should look for why that image was so frightening to Rome. What was it about that image that made it so frightening? The famines of Nero's day, for example, we talked a little bit about them last week. They preceded the writing of this book. The famines of Domitian's day that we talked about, they followed the writing of this book. The former, I think, was probably a source of why it was used, because it was so frightening to Rome, the idea of famine. And then the later one was probably a reminder of that image. But in both cases, it was a powerful, vivid, frightening image to Rome. The first horse that we talked about is a very good example. I identified it with a Parthian warrior, because Rome had this fear of invasion from the east. Did Parthia conquer Rome? No, it did not. Were the Romans scared to death of a Parthian warrior coming across the border to conquer them? Yes, they were. God is looking into their minds and pulling out the things that scare them the most and telling them that that and much more is on its way. Rome feared invasion from the east. Rome feared a loss of Roman peace. Rome feared famine. Rome feared pestilence and disease. Why did they fear these things? Because they were actual threats. They saw them. They saw that these things could happen to them. That had happened and would happen again. The church saw Rome as invincible. Mighty Rome. What could be done against mighty Rome? Rome saw itself as invincible. God is reminding both Rome and the church that it is not invincible. But how and when did these judgments come to pass against Rome? Scott.
I have one question for you. Obviously, you know, you mentioned some of the things that aren't relevant to this book, like premillennialism. Obviously, there's been a lot of interest the last few years in Nostradamus and all of his predictions and everything, and some people try to find the historical significance in things like the Black Plague that hit Europe that killed, 60-70% of the population at the time?
Mm-hmm.
What's your opinion on those types of things, and is that like a dual fulfillment?
I don't think we can. The question is, what about the Black Plague and some of the diseases that have struck the globe? Could that possibly be a dual fulfillment? In my opinion, no. As we talked about last week, if we wanted to look for the greatest plague to strike mankind, we don't have to go back very far, 1918. There have always been plagues. We're going to see today plagues that struck Rome throughout its history. There have always been plagues striking mankind. According to the news, we may be on the verge of another one right now. So that's a problem that Nostradamus has in general, and that is his prophecies did not come with a time frame. There is exactly one prophecy, if we want to call it that, of Nostradamus that has a time frame. One. Of all the ones he wrote, one had a time frame, and it did not happen. How and when did these judgments come to pass against Rome? Well, we've already seen Rome, and particularly the Roman emperors, suffered literal punishments in this life. But before we conclude that's all there is, let's pause and ask a question. The reward of the martyrs that we saw last week under the altar, did that reward happen in heaven or on earth? It was a heavenly reward, obviously. They were killed on earth. That was the last thing that happened to them on earth, was being martyred. They were killed. Their reward was in heaven. The punishment of Rome, on earth or in hell? I think perhaps what we're seeing here is a description in vivid language of what Paul told us in Hebrews 10:31. It is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of a living God. You take everything that scared Rome, and it was nothing compared to the eternal punishments that awaited them. I think we're sometimes too quick to put the reward in heaven and the punishment on earth. There's also a punishment in hell awaiting these persecutors of God's people. This book invites us to see things through God's eyes. And in God's eyes, there is not any earthly punishment that compares in any way to the punishments in hell. Some of these events would happen on earth, but the real punishment would happen in the next life, just as the real reward would happen in the next life for those who were faithful. Think about some of the figures we're about to see in this book. The sun blackened, the stars falling to earth, the sky rolled up like a scroll, every mountain and island moved out of its place, hail and fire with blood, the sea becoming blood, a great mountain cast into the sea, stars darkened, horses with serpent tails, unclean spirits like frogs coming from the mouth of a dragon. Figurative? I think we'd agree that is figurative. Then what about the famine, the war, and the pestilence? Literal? If so, why? Why is that? Why are those three things literal and all those other things figurative? Remember, our general rule with apocalyptic language is that we take the images figuratively unless we're forced for some reason to do otherwise. That's our general rule with apocalyptic language. If the horse with the serpent's tail is figurative, I think that the famine, the war, the pestilence can also be fearful images that Rome would recognize and understand. Now, I'll tell you right now, our plan is not to try to mix and match each image with something in history, in the history of Rome. I don't think that would be very profitable, and I don't think that would be a proper interpretation of the book. Instead, these images are all describing the same judgment, but just from different perspectives with an ever-building intensity. Remember, we're just at the beginning on the seals. We're going to have trumpets and bowls of wrath poured out, getting worse and worse and worse for Rome. We see similar language in the Old Testament. God told the Babylonians in Isaiah 13 that he would leave their land in such a wasted condition that no Arab would ever pitch his tent there again. Is that literally what happened to them? No. Was it a frightening image intended to convey the horror of what God had planned for them? Yes. Hosea told Israel that it would go into Egyptian bondage. Did that literally happen to them? No. Was Egyptian bondage a frightening image from their past that meant a great deal to them and denoted slavery? Yes. And that's why that image was used. Fourth question. How can this book be about the fall of Rome when that event did not occur until 476 A.D.? I think we can all agree that if Rome had been sacked in 110 instead of 410, that everyone would agree Rome's the villain and the judgment's against Rome. But Rome was not sacked in 110. It was sacked in 410. And then it finally fell, if we call it that, in 476. Let's look at an Old Testament comparison to help us answer this question. We're going to look in a moment at Isaiah 13, so you might be flipping over there. And before we get there, though, let's look at the handout. You'll notice on the handout, here's a lengthy quote, which I'm not going to read to you here today, but it's a quote that kind of gives a very nice summary of the fall of Rome and how it came to be. That book that it's from is a book that lists a bunch of different theories for why Rome fell. I believe there's nearly 300 of them enumerated in that book. And we're looking at the correct one in our book, Book of Revelation. But there's a lot of different theories for why Rome fell. And this little excerpt from the introduction of that book gives a nice overview of the events. Certainly when most people think of the fall of Rome, they're thinking of the fall of the Western Empire, and they're thinking of the 5th century. 476, for example, is when, as the description here explains, the last Roman emperor was deposed and he was tossed off the throne by the barbarian who took over. There were other events, though, that occurred. There were plagues and earthquakes, as this excerpt talks about. And in fact, this secular author, he even makes the connection with the four horsemen of the apocalypse. You can see it there at the end of the first paragraph. And then he talks about the important dates, 410 when Rome was sacked, 476 when the final Roman emperor was retired. There were a lot of other events, though, even preceding that. There was a lot of political instability in the 3rd century. Rome was a train coming off the tracks. It finally came off the tracks in the 5th century, but it had been coming off the tracks a lot earlier than that, going all the way back even to the 3rd century. Some take it even further back than that. After Rome, the Western Rome Empire fell, then you have the Eastern Empire that does hang around for a long time, but it's very hard to make a good connection with the glory of Rome in the West. And again, this excerpt mentions that. As for the fall of Rome, though, happening hundreds of years after Revelation was written, it may be that in Revelation we are seeing the judgment, and that later in history we're seeing the sentence coming about as a result of that judgment. That was the case with Jerusalem, for example. It wasn't quite as long, but Jesus judged them in Matthew 24. When Jesus said that in Matthew 24, it was certain. It was going to happen. When did it happen? 40 years later. 40 years later in AD 70, when Rome marched against the city. Not every judgment happens like Sodom and Gomorrah. Yes, God has atom bombs that he can drop on people when he wants to, but he doesn't always do it that way. Yes, he did it with Sodom and Gomorrah. One day, a cataclysmic event, that is not what happened with Rome. It's also not happened with what not. It did not happen with other countries that were judged in the Old Testament. We're about to look at an example in Isaiah 13. With the fall of Jerusalem, Jesus gave a warning. Remember, he told the Christians what to look for, that when they saw that, they could flee the city. Perhaps with Rome, God was also delaying for the sake of the righteous. It's a possibility. But, and this is the key point, the judgment was certain. The judgment was certain. In fact, the judgment had been written about by Daniel 600 years before this vision that John sees in writing the book of Revelation. So 1,000 years before the 5th century, God had a plan for Rome, and that plan included Rome's judgment. And who was given the harsher penalty? Let me ask that. Sodom and Gomorrah, which was taken out in a spectacular but very quick manner, or Rome, who died a slow death of 1,000 cuts and finally just drifted into obscurity and irrelevance? Perhaps that's another reason the sentence was delayed, or should we say the sentence was prolonged. The city of Rome experienced a steep decline from the heights that we're seeing here when this is being written. Diocletian, for example, ruled from 284 to 305. He established 4 capital cities of the Roman Empire, not one of which was Rome. That's how far Rome had drifted from its heights. In fact, one commentator says that Diocletian turned the great Roman Senate into just a municipal council. That's how far the city of Rome had fallen in just a short period of time. We should keep in mind also that the two central villains, as far as the church was concerned at this time, was not Rome, was not the city of Rome, it was the Roman emperors, Nero and Domitian, By the time this book was written, Nero had already been taken off the stage. Domitian had not. Revelation was written between their two reigns. What happened to Domitian? He was murdered by his own servants. His body was unceremoniously cremated. So much for our Lord and God Domitian, which is how he wanted to be called.
Eric,
yes?
You know, one thing I want to throw out there too. Sodom and Gomorrah, God couldn't find any righteous men in the city, right? There was no use in death by a thousand cuts, right? It was like, it was prudent for the Lord to just end it right there. Think about how many Christians, how many souls were saved out of that Roman Empire that the gospel message was spreading across. I think that death by a thousand cuts was a perfect example of God's mercy in pulling out the people that he would have out of that entity.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point. Yeah, that may be the case. He may have prolonged it or delayed it for the sake of the righteous. He's done that before. We see it. Rome's judgment was certain, and its punishment began soon after this book was written, just as the book said it was, and just as the book said it would. But that punishment, I don't think, ended soon after this book was written. I think it continued. Rome was not built in a day. Rome did not end in a day. Now let's look at the Old Testament for an example. Isaiah 13 and 14 contain a prophecy about the destruction of Babylon by the Medes and the Persians. Isaiah 13 and 14. The imagery and the language used in that part of the Isaiah suggests a destruction that would happen swiftly and dramatically. And we're going to read some of that in a moment when we get on into chapter 6. Is that what happened to Babylon? Well, one commentator in his commentary on Isaiah says the fulfillment of this remarkable prophecy was progressive. He writes, after Cyrus invaded Babylon in 539 BC, he left the city standing, making it one of his capitals. Eventually, though, the city revolted. And in 516 BC, Darius, the Persian king, invaded it and dismantled the walls. In 482 BC, the Babylonian settlement again revolted. And that was put down by Xerxes. Finally, in 20 BC, one Greek geographer described Babylon as a vast desolation. It happened in a series of events over hundreds of years. Haley, his commentary on Isaiah, makes the same point. Isaiah compares Babylon to the fall of Sodom and Gomorrah. Did it happen like the fall of Sodom and Gomorrah? Literally, in a day. The answer is no. Haley writes, one might infer from this that the destruction would be immediate, but that was not the case. Delitzsch says that Cyrus left the city still standing. Darius had to conquer it a second time. Xerxes gave the last thrust to the glory of the temple in Babylon. And again, a Greek geographer described it as a perfect desert after that time. How is that judgment described by Isaiah? Well, look at Isaiah 13, 21 through 22. Wild beasts of the desert shall lie there. Their houses shall be full of doleful creatures, and owls shall dwell there. Satyrs shall dance there. And the wild beasts of the island shall cry in their desolate houses, and dragons in their pleasant palaces. Her time is near to come, and her days shall not be prolonged. Isaiah 13 was written after the death of King Ahaz in 715 BC, which put it comparatively late in Isaiah's ministry. If we take 715 to be the date when that prophecy was written, then it began to be fulfilled 175 years later, in 539, when Cyrus invaded the city. If we take the destruction by Xerxes in 482 to be the death blow, then that blow came 235 years after that prophecy was written in Isaiah 13. If we jump ahead to Rome and look at the invasion of the city in 410, the sacking of Rome, that was 340 years after the prophecy was penned. In short, not only are these prophecies similar, but their timetables are similar. We're going to look at more similarities as we get into chapter 6, but let's keep in mind Isaiah 13 and 14. I think it's an Old Testament example of what we're seeing here in Revelation. And we are getting close to chapter 6. One final question. Are we kings or are we a kingdom? That was asked last week.
Last week we noted that Revelation 5:10 in the King James says we shall reign. American Standard says we reign. Both have good textual support in the Greek manuscripts. We just can't know for sure which was in the original. But it doesn't matter because both are accurate. Both are exactly accurate descriptions. And we talked about why they're both accurate. We will reign and we do reign. The same verse is the source of yet another textual disagreement. In the King James, we read, He has made us kings and priests. In the English Standard, for example, we read, He has made us a kingdom and priest, which is correct. Again, both have good textual support. And each is an accurate description of the church. Recall the 24 elders in Revelation 4 represent the church, and they are wearing crowns. They are reigning in life with Christ. Romans 5:17, Revelation 3:11, Ephesians 2:5-7. We reign in life with Christ. And of course, God made us a kingdom. The church is His kingdom. We are a kingdom of priests. We are also a kingdom of kings, with Jesus as our high priest and as our King of kings. I think at the end of our lesson last week, I read chapter 6, verses 12 through 17. So I won't read those again. Let's begin discussing those. Chapter 6, verses 12 through 17. The removal of the sixth seal reveals the wrath of the Lamb and the judgment of the ungodly. And you'll recall the language in the passages we read last week. Does this seal describe the final judgment and the end of all time? Well, most commentators, many certainly, probably most, would say it does. But in studying Revelation, I'm always reminded of something Mark Twain once said. Whenever you find yourself on the side of the majority, it's probably time to change sides. And that's good advice in many aspects of life. It's certainly good advice when you find yourself on the side of most of the world's commentaries on Revelation. The language here is language of judgment. And as language of judgment, it could be used to describe many judgments in the Bible, including the great and final judgment yet to come. But what is the context here? What is the time frame of the book? Is there another judgment under consideration here? Well, remember one of our key interpretive principles. Similarity of language does not prove identity of subject. Just because this same language could be used to describe other judgments and has been used to describe other judgments does not mean those are the judgments we're looking at here. We've got to look at the context. I like what one commentator said on that. He said, "We must take the trouble to learn as much as possible concerning the historical situation to which the book of Revelation belongs. It is only when this historical situation is reconstructed that Revelation comes alive and we are able to enter sympathetically into the mind and heart of the author and his readers. Perhaps no other book of the Bible has suffered more from being wrenched from its historical context than has Revelation." Amen. The language used to describe the opening of the sixth seal is a mosaic of phrases from the Old Testament used to describe past judgments. What about the burning fire and brimstone? Isaiah 34:9 uses that language to describe the judgment against Edom. What about the darkening of the sun and the moon? Joel 2:31 uses the same language to describe something that Acts 2 tells us for certain happened in the first century. You can also look at Amos and Isaiah and Ezekiel and Matthew. All of these scriptures are in my notes, by the way, all available on thywordistruth.com. What about the falling of the stars, the removing of the heavens? Isaiah 34, verse 4 uses the same language to describe a judgment in Isaiah's day. Matthew 24:29 that we've already looked at and that we know from verse 34 in Matthew 24 happened in the first century. It uses very similar language to describe the fall of Jerusalem. Just because we see language describing the sun being darkened and the stars falling and the earth being rolled up like a scroll does not mean for sure that that's the end of the world. Those things will happen someday, literally. But that same language of judgment is used throughout the scripture to denote judgments by God. Let's now look more closely at that one from Isaiah 13. And I want to go ahead and read a lengthy section from Isaiah 13 because the language is so strikingly similar to what we're seeing here in the book of Revelation. And as I read Isaiah 13, starting in verse 4, think about the language we're seeing here in Revelation against Rome This language from Isaiah is against Babylon. Hark, a tumult on the mountains as of a great multitude. Hark, an uproar of kingdoms, of nations gathering together. The Lord of hosts is mustering a host for battle. They come from a distant land, from the ends of the heavens. The Lord and the weapons of his indignation to destroy the whole earth. Wail, for the day of the Lord is near. As destruction from the Almighty it will come. Therefore all hands will be feeble and every man's heart will melt and they will be dismayed. Pangs and agony will seize them. They will be in anguish like a woman in travail. They will look aghast at one another. Their faces will be aflame. Behold, the day of the Lord comes, cruel with wrath and fierce anger, to make the earth a desolation and to destroy its sinners from it. For the stars of the heavens and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be dark as its rising, and the moon will not shed its light. I will punish the world for its evil and the wicked for their iniquity. I will put an end to the pride of the arrogant and lay low the haughtiness of the ruthless. I will make men more rare than fine gold and mankind than the gold of Ophir. Therefore I will make the heavens tremble. The earth will be shaken out of its place as the wrath of the Lord of hosts in that day of his fierce anger. Skipping down a few verses. And Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the splendor and pride of the Chaldeans, will be like Sodom and Gomorrah when God overthrew them. It will never be inhabited or dwelt in for all generations. No Arab will pitch his tent there. No shepherds will make their flocks lie down there. But wild beasts will lie down there. Its houses will be full of howling creatures. There ostriches will dwell. There satyrs will dance. Hyenas will cry in its towers and jackals in the pleasant places. Its time is close at hand. Its days will not be prolonged. That description of Babylon's judgment looks kind of familiar, doesn't it? The same language is used here to describe the judgment of Rome, which was the Babylon of John's day. Was the language in Isaiah 13 a literal description of events? No, we know it was not. Isaiah 13 says, no Arab will pitch his tent there ever again. And yet a few Arabs, quite a few in fact, have pitched their tents there and are pitching their tents there today. Babylon is where Iraq is. Does this language from Revelation apply to the end of the world? Well, many would say, well, yes, the context seems to imply it was going to happen soon, but this vivid language could only apply to the end of the world. Well, tell that to Babylon. Babylon got the same language applied to them. They came to an end, and yet the world continues to this very day. Our investigation of this language gives us an important reminder. We cannot study Revelation apart from the Old Testament. No other book in the New Testament refers more to the Old Testament than does the book of Revelation. Barclay writes, strange as John's pictures may seem to us, there is not a single detail which is not in the Old Testament. We must not think that these pictures are to be taken literally. Their point is that John is taking every terrifying thing that can be imagined and piling them all together to give a picture of the terrors to come. What about the staggering of the earth and the mountains in verse 14? Well, we know the manifestation of God's glory produced a literal trembling of the mountain on Sinai. And that literal trembling became a symbol for God's presence, his coming and judgment that was used elsewhere. You can find the original event in Exodus 19, verse 18. And then you can see many subsequent symbolic uses. Hosea 2:6, I will shake the heavens and the earth. That's Haggai 2:6. Nahum 1:5. The mountains quake. Jeremiah 4:23-24. They were quaking. Micah 1:4. The earth, the mountains will melt. Isaiah 13:13. The earth will be shaken out of its place. The mountains literally quaked at Sinai. After that, literal quaking was used to figuratively depict a judgment by God. What about the sun, the moon, the stars, the sky, the whole earth being affected? Doesn't that mean it's going to be a global event? Well, first, of course, the immediate answer is that to the people of Rome's day, it was a global event. Rome ruled the known world. Rome was global as far as they were concerned. But whenever the godly or ungodly, rather, are dominant in this world, the world is said to be theirs. And God will judge the world of the ungodly. Isaiah 13:11, 2 Peter 2:5. What we see is God dismantling and attacking his own creation, to get rid of the ungodly men that have invaded it and have spoiled it. And we see that language both in the Old Testament, we're seeing that language here. Rome thought Rome was in charge. God is telling them, no, I'm in charge. Generally, we should try to see things through God's eyes in this book, or through the early church's eyes. Sometimes it's going to help us to see things through Rome's eyes. The picture here is one of a total and unexpected breakdown in order. Rome thought it had covered every base, but it had not included God in its plans. Always a mistake. Christians can look forward to the day of the Lord, to the coming of the Lord. Not true for the ungodly. And in fact, verse 15 says, this fear touches all levels of their society. No one is immune from this, from the emperor all the way down. Is this language of judgment literal? Literal darkness, literal stars falling, literal dismantling of the world? Again, we've seen Old Testament examples where the same language was used figuratively. We see it in Matthew 24 for the fall of Jerusalem. We see it here for Rome. Just as symbols can be based on literal past events, like the quaking at Sinai, I think they can also be based on literal future events. Someday the earth will be destroyed by fire. Someday the heavens will be rolled up like a scroll. And God, I think, is pointing to that last great judgment and using things that will literally happen to describe things that he's doing now or at the time this book was being written. The search for a hiding place in verse 16. We also see that in Isaiah 2. There's no place to hide from God. It's so interesting to watch the ungodly try to hide in a book called Revelation, revealing. God reveals. The ungodly are hiding. Sweet reminds us what sinners fear most is not death, but the revealed presence of God. And we see that all the way back to the events in the garden and following the events of the garden. The wrath of the Lamb in verse 16, one of the most remarkable and fearful expressions anywhere in the Bible, perhaps the most. The word wrath is used one time in the Gospels in reference to Jesus. Mark 3:5. He looked around them at them with anger, grieved at their hardness of heart, and said to the man, stretch out your hand, and his hand was restored. That's the word, the wrath of the Lamb. You know, we all know what makes God happy. But it's just as important that we all know what makes God angry. Because here we're seeing not just a lamb, not just a lamb that was slain, but the wrath of that lamb. I love what C.S. Lewis said on this point. He wrote, in the end, the face which is the delight or the terror of the universe must be turned upon each of us, either with one expression or with the other, either conferring glory inexpressible or inflicting shame that can never be cured or disguised. The wrath of the Lamb. And the good news is that we don't have to experience the wrath of the Lamb. That Lamb died for us so that we would not have to experience the wrath of the Lamb. Rome, however, is not in that situation, and Rome is about to experience the wrath of the Lamb. We're about to move into chapter 7. Chapter 7, we're going to find, is an interlude between the sixth seal and the seventh seal. This chapter, beautiful chapter 7, is intended to provide comfort and to reinforce the message of this book, which is victory in Jesus. In doing so, chapter 7 is going to answer the question that appeared at the end of chapter 6. Who can stand before the wrath of God? We're going to find in chapter 7 an answer to that question. If I get back from Korea, next week we'll be in chapter 7. Thank you very much for your attention.